All right, my friends, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I screwed up, and I didn't tell the producer which Star Wars song to play, so we went with the default there. But that's all right, because later I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to edit in Star Wars music. And so when people hear the archive of this on my website, weekendinterviewshow.com, they're not going to have any idea what the hell I'm talking about. In fact, I might just edit out this entire part, too. So they really won't know. Hey, everybody, let's why don't you help me welcome Mark Thornton to the show, even though he can't hear you. He does believe in you. He's an economist and senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, is the book review editor for the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics. He's the author of The Economics of Prohibition and co-author of Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War. So welcome back to the show, Mark Thornton.
Hey, Scott, great to be here with you today.
Oh, it's great to have you back on the show, sir. Let's see, where to start here? I think I'm going to ask you for your first question. Is Darth Vader the best movie bad guy of all time, or what?
Well, I mean, you've really got to think that he is the greatest, most well-known fictional bad guy, in human history. The Star Wars saga is certainly one of the greatest selling series of movies of all time. Even if you adjust it for inflation, you've got six movies. They're all going to be blockbusters. The sales of all the games and clothing and, you know, games and all sorts of things related to Star Wars make it the biggest cultural single impact thing in modern history. And, you know, and Darth Vader is the central key character to all that. And, you know, when Lucas brought him onto the screen in 1977, just a few minutes into the movie, and he sort of comes onto stage and comes through the smoke, and he's got this black cape, the black helmet and the breathing apparatus and all that. I mean, everybody just knew that this guy was a bad guy, and he's been capturing people's imagination around the world ever since, for more than a quarter century, and probably for a long time to come.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's funny just how deep within the popular culture Star Wars is. I mean, the fact that we're coming up on the release of a new movie right now is one thing. But, you know, even, you know, if you're in a time period between Star Wars movies where it's not really on people's brains that much, you'll still hear comparisons all the time. Wow, look at the stealth fighter. It looks like Darth Vader. Or little Lamborghini Countach. It looks like Darth Vader. Or you hear the prefix name Darth applied to Darth Chaney and Darth Wolfowitz, and you know
exactly
it really is just throughout the entire popular culture up and down.
You know, and the good side, you know, Yoda and the Jedi concept. You see high school bands playing Darth Vader's theme song. And you hear people applying the term the dark side, you know, to bad groups and, you know, nasty politicians and all sorts of different things. And when you use that term, everybody knows exactly what you mean, even if they've not seen a Star Wars movie.
Right, which there's very few people left, I think, who haven't seen them.
Very few people, but, you know, I'm talking about maybe your grandmother or something
right.
who has been through a Star Wars movie or something like that. You know, they know what it is, and they've seen images of Darth Vader of some sort or another. And, you know, Lucas is just right on the money when he put together that costume and that breathing, that sound of that breathing and the helmet and just the whole nine yards. It was just a masterstroke.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Mark Thornton. He's an economist from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Hang tight, we'll be right back.
Thank you.
right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I am Scott Horton, and this is the Republic Broadcasting Network. My guest is Mark Thornton. He's an economist from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, but we're having fun today instead of talking about warfare and free markets and cool stuff like that. We're talking about Star Wars, because, hey, Star Wars is fun. Mark, you started writing articles about Star Wars for the Mises Institute right around the time of Episode 1, I guess right after you saw Episode 1, right?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I was a Star Wars fan, sort of, and I went to see, you know, I had to go see Episode 1, and I saw that scroll come down, and I was just blown away. You know, it was talking about taxes and blockades and embargoes and all that kind of stuff leading to intergalactic conflict and, you know, all this sort of thing. And I thought, my God, this whole thing is based on an economic problem, and that the Republic was degenerating into empire because they had followed all these mercantilist policies of, you know, protectionism and tariffs and regulating this and regulating that.
I think you said in one of your articles that it seems like maybe George Lucas, in some of his time off between movies, maybe he's been sitting around reading some Ludwig von Mises or some Murray Rothbard, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he's not Hollywood. He went to Hollywood to start a different mold. He's very entrepreneurial. He's very much into pleasing his customers, unlike some people in Hollywood who are only interested in pleasing themselves. Lucas really is an entrepreneur, you know, and he's a student of human history. And if he hasn't read Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises, he's picked up enough of it somewhere along the lines that he understands where the Austrians are coming from. And, you know, and I just put that down on paper, and I was blown away, and I think my readers were blown away by the analysis that I basically am taking from Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard's books, that, you know, if the government gets involved in the economy, all sorts of bad things happen. And if this continues, it builds on itself, the government gets bigger, it gets more corrupt, it gets more bureaucratic, and people's liberties are taken away, civil liberties are taken away, and the whole thing degenerates down into empire and then eventually chaos. And, you know, we saw that with all the historical empires, the Greek, the Roman, the British empires, going through the same pattern. And Lucas used that pattern as a foundation for his movies.
Right. And let's get into more specifically. In Episode 1, you wrote, and this was just, I mean, I'm pretty up to date on this kind of thing. Like I said before, I'm about a level 2 or level 3 Star Wars dork. And I was just absolutely floored. Wow. So Episode 1 is all about the British Empire, huh?
Yeah, you know, you see images of British Empire in this movie with images from India, which Britain controlled as part of their empire, and images from Jamaica, which, of course, Britain controlled as part of its empire. And, you know, you've got the regulations and all that kind of nonsense going on, but he's drawing from these historical experiences. So the reader's not, excuse me, the viewer is not really aware of it, but all of these images and all of this historical background makes the viewer comfortable and makes the viewer think that this is all plausible. You know, it's plausible.
Right, even though it's in outer space and long ago and far away.
Right, exactly.
And you talk about how, in your article, you talk about how the Queen, the way she speaks, very practiced, precise English, is very much how, like, a very educated Indian woman would speak English. You talk about the Gungans, Jar Jar Binks, and his race of people represent the Jamaicans. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, a lot of people tried to say that the Jar Jar Binks character was a racist character, that Bush was making fun of black people by creating the character of Jar Jar Binks.
Exactly. You know, people are immediately jumping to politically correct, politically incorrect sort of analysis, which, of course, never works, you know, as a good explanatory tool. But once people saw that Lucas wasn't making fun of people, he was drawing from reality and sometimes stereotypes, but it is reality. And, you know, and I think that's part of his success. And part of my success is just following up on all that stuff. Once you see the key to it, it all falls into line, and the whole six-part series is tied together for you. So it's been really great. I mean, I've got a new article on www.mises.org on the latest movie, and people are writing in and saying, you know, this is the greatest article I've ever read. Well, you know, it's not.
It was pretty good.
Well, yeah, but it's not. It's just a great subject matter to be dealing with. It's not. It doesn't have anything to do with my own greatness. It just has a really captivating subject. And Lucas has used that science fiction mythology, I think, to teach us a lesson and to reach out to humanity with this historical tale, science fiction form, that really makes sense and gets us all thinking.
Right. Well, okay, I spent the last hour basically explaining the broad story of Star Wars and how the senator makes himself chancellor and eventually makes himself emperor and all that kind of thing. So assuming that anybody's been listening through all that and is still here, everybody's pretty much up on the story and exactly how it goes. But I want to focus a little more on the historical analogies. There's so many different analogies in the Star Wars movies to Vietnam, to the American Revolution, to the Civil War, to, as you began to describe there, the British Empire, the rise of the Nazis, the French Revolution, the Roman Empire. And, you know, I want to go ahead and, like, be a little bit specific. In your article, you talk about how, well, in fact, here's a good spot to start. It's sort of confusing in episode one, exactly who is this Trade Federation? Who is it that they're working for? I mean, besides they're being manipulated by the Sith Lord and the hologram, but who exactly is the Trade Federation? The general interpretation, I think, is that they're corrupt businessmen who want free trade and are complaining about the high taxes, and that's why they seized the planet. But in your article, you say that's a misunderstanding, and that the Trade Federation actually represents an entirely separate paradigm there.
Yes, I mean, it does appear that Lucas is painting businessmen as bad and greedy and that sort of thing. But the type of business person or group that Lucas is really defining here is a historical entity similar to what you might call like the East India Company. And the East India Company was really a government-created monopoly that had profit motivation. In other words, if they succeeded in exploiting a country, they got to keep a lot of the profits, and some of the money would go to the government itself. And this company would essentially be given all sorts of authority. In addition to monopoly, they would be given political authority, and they would be given the right to, you know, get battleships or, you know, spaceships in this case, and go out and use essentially what is government force. And so even though they're dressed up like businessmen, even though they're called a trade federation, essentially what it is an allusion back to the English East India Company, which was a government-created monopoly with warships and soldiers and taxing authority, the authority to suppress native populations, to enslave people, to throw people in jail. Basically, it's the worst form of organization on the planet, where you give people the government authority over life and death and freedom, and yet you give them an open-ended profit motive at the same time. So you know, the Trade Federation is an evil thing, and Lucas is drawing on our historical experience.
So it's not an attack on capitalism so much as it's an attack on the mercantilist combination between those private profit-seeking interests and the state.
Yes.
Which I guess means Naboo are the ones protesting the high taxes, not the Trade Federation, right? They're the ones collecting them.
That's right. The Naboo are not willing to comply with the trade regulations and to pay these taxes. And so they're, you know, basically saying, we've had enough of this, and we're rebelling against that kind of government intervention, just as, you know, groups in India and Jamaica and South Africa and so on and so forth rebelled against these government trading monopolies and were suppressed, at the point of a gun. And so the Naboo are standing up for freedom, and the Trade Federation is trying to impose this kind of quasi-government authority.
All right. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton talking with Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute. We'll be right back. Guys, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute. All about Star Wars, coming out this Thursday. I've been waiting since I was about, well, I don't know how old I was when I first found out that they were ever going to do episodes 1, 2, and 3. Probably when I was about 7 or 8 years old. So I've been waiting about 20 years. That's fair enough. I want to play this soundbite again real quick. I like this one.
Every single Jedi, including your friend, Obi-Wan Kenobi, is now an enemy of the Republic. Do what must be done, Lord Vader. Do not hesitate. Show no mercy.
All right. How a Republic becomes an Empire. Deception. That's easy. Nobody would really willingly give their Republic away, would they? No, probably not. They got to be fooled into it. So, yeah, Mark Thornton, moving on from episode one. Oh, no, actually, let's stick with episode one for a second. Another theme in episode one that is touched on, however briefly, is the fiat money system and the difficulty the Jedi Knights have trying to buy a hyperdrive with Republic credits.
Yeah, I mean, that's another example of mercantilism, where the government takes over the monetary system from the economy and then, you know, throws out gold or silver and puts paper money in its place, and then devalues it, debases it, and people everywhere are paying this hidden tax of government inflation, and eventually, of course, the money becomes worthless. And the more the government grows, the more worthless the currency becomes. And, you know, they were on the planet there trying to buy parts, and they had basically an unlimited supply of, you know, of government paper money, but nobody wanted to take it out there in the hinterlands because they knew that by the time they got it back into the, you know, other areas of the Republic to spend it, it would have lost so much of its value that they simply weren't willing to take it. So, you know, Lucas throws all this stuff in here over and over again. He's, you know, feeding the audience these little bits of science fiction, which are based on hard core reality.
You also make a note in your newest column, which is, by the way, up at lewrockwell.com today. It's at least in the vault. If it's not right there on the front, right there in the middle, it's at least on the right side of the page there on lewrockwell.com. And in that most recent article, you also focus on Anakin as a bastard son, which I thought was interesting. Most people's take on Anakin, they're trying to figure out the Jesus angle because of the virgin birth. but you really take the other angle. This is a kid without a father.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, the mother says that there was no father, but, you know, I think that, you know, I don't think Lucas is really playing this up as a Immaculate Conception, Christ-like figure, or Antichrist or anything like that. I mean, I think the kid grew up without a father, and, you know, and that's a very difficult thing for any child. And, you know, so Anakin has got really three strikes against him. He's, you know, he grows up without a father. He's born into slavery. His mother's a slave. He's a slave. They can't go anywhere because there's some kind of transmitter device that's built into them that keeps track of them, prevents them from leaving. And, you know, and of course, slavery, in addition to not having a father, you know, being a slave is just an awful, incredibly burdensome psychological burden on anyone. And we see this, of course, through history as well. And so, you know, the situation that Anakin is brought up in is just devastating. And then because he wins the racing tournament, he's given his freedom after winning the racing tournament, but his mother isn't freed. And so he has to abandon his mother in slavery. And so, you know, he already knows the feeling of abandonment. He already knows what being a slave is. And now here he's leaving his mother in this. And, you know, so he is, you know, very cute, very talented little kid. But the psychological burden on this child is just incredible. I mean, Lucas has built this scenario up into the point where you can't imagine anybody having more difficulty, you know, psychologically speaking, in life because of all those circumstances.
And that's part of the story, is that they raise the Jedi Knights from the time they're infants so that they never have a chance to form those kind of attachments and live that kind of burden life. Because we see what happens when somebody that a Jedi loves very much is brutally murdered. They kind of snap.
Yeah, he goes back to find his mother only to find out that she's been brutalized, possibly raped, and lives only long enough to die in Anakin's arms. And so, you know, this really reinforces abandoning his mother. And, of course, Anakin and two just becomes enraged against the raiders there that have taken his mother and brutalized her. And how he goes about wiping them all out, killing them all, a very un-Jedi-like act.
Yeah, and definitely another step toward the dark side. All right, everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. We're talking Star Wars with Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute. Stay tuned. Didn't we all grow up in love with Princess Leia? I still am. I can't help it, man. Her mom's kind of a hottie, too. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Beware of the dark side. Anger, fear, aggression. The dark side of the Force of the easily they flow. Quick to join you in a fight. If once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny. Consume you it will.
Is the dark side stronger?
No. No. But the easier, more seductive.
But how am I to know the good side from the bad?
You will know when you are calm, at peace, passive. A Jedi uses the Force for knowledge and defense. Never attack.
But tell me why I can't.
No, there is no why. Nothing more will I teach you today.
All right, I'm up here goofing off. I hope John Statmiller's not out there listening, questioning whether he ought to still let me have a show up here or not. You guys know that I do a hardcore show up here every week. That's set today. Okay, Mark Thornton is a real economist. No kidding about that. He's from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which is apparently the only economists on Earth that believe that liberty is probably the best way to run an economy. Go figure. So anyway, yeah, welcome back to the show. Mark, say hi to everybody.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? I would want to point out that, you know, there's a lot of economists out there that claim to support liberty and claim to support free markets and, you know, no government intervention in the economy, but it's only the Austrians that really stick to that. And, you know, you see these Chicago school economists and people from other schools of economic thought. Well, when push comes to shove, they themselves turn to the dark side and advocate government intervention. And, you know, so you've got to be weary. You'll see a lot of economists claiming to be free market, but they're not necessarily Austrian school economists.
Oh, absolutely. I'll back that up. I mean, you look at the history of which we're kind of moseying off of the Star Wars topic here, but you look at when all the Friedmanites came into power with Ronald Reagan and all their monetarism and measuring M1 quantities every day and all that, it was a disaster. It was still a government intervention. It was just they had picked a little bit different so-called science to do their measuring by.
Yeah, they actually came in with a sort of an advocacy of returning to the gold standard, and they had a gold commission set up, which was packed with anti-gold people, and they ended up, instead of returning our monetary system to gold and silver, they issued some commemorative coins.
Oh, nice.
I mean, you know, that is the dark side right there, if I've ever seen it.
Absolutely, and by the time Reagan left office, they had a $4 trillion debt, so definitely no gold standard there.
No, none at all.
It's only 9 now. Okay, now back to Star Wars, because that's what's really important here. And episode 2. Now, I read an article, I don't think this one was one of yours, but I read an article on LouRockwell.com called Chancellor Palpatine, Meet Abraham Lincoln. And I thought, oh, wow, episode 2, all about the American Civil War, huh?
Yeah, in the first episode, what Lucas is drawing from is British imperialism and British mercantilism and things like that. And then in episode 2, it switches over to the United States and the American Civil War. And, you know, and that historically is kind of like when the United States became a world power and we sort of took over, you know, in the 19th century, the leading world power status from Britain, and we brought it to the United States. So Lucas makes that jump as well. And, you know, and I think there is an analogy there between Palpatine and Lincoln as well. And, you know, Lincoln, during the Civil War, got all sorts of emergency war powers from the U.S. Congress, including, you know, suppression of civil liberties, habeas corpus, the whole nine yards, was able to jail political prisoners for the duration of the war without trial, without any juries being called, without even grand juries being brought together. And, you know, so Lincoln became America's first emperor, in a sense, in that he had this massive power, that he had the power to print money, that he had the power to impose tariffs, that he had the power to raise huge armies and to invade the southern states. And, you know, and so there is a very good connection there between what we see in Star Wars and what we see in American history, to the extent that it still is in American history books. I mean, they very rarely talk about Lincoln's power grabs and his suppression of civil liberties, but they were extensive during the American Civil War.
Well, and even where those stories are whitewashed, we basically all understand that it was during the Civil War when the Union became the nation and the United States plural became the United States singular. And
that's right, and that's what's going on in Star Wars, too. Instead of, you know, each planet being an independent, self-governing, unique civilization or groups of civilizations. In the process of Star Wars, you see them all coming under the rubric of the Empire, where everything is controlled centrally rather than an individual states seeking their own destiny. The Empire or the Union, and basically with Union in the United States, basically everybody has to go along with what the national government says. And you're not allowed out. You can't vote yourself out, or you can't say, no, we're not going to go along with that. You're basically a prisoner of the larger political unit. And that's what happens in the United States during the American Civil War, is we lose our status as individual states, and individual states become just merely franchises of the powerful national or central government.
Even in your article, you say that that Emperor Palpatine actually names the clone army of stormtroopers after Abraham Lincoln's army?
Yeah, the Grand Army of the Republic. Boy, that really hits you in the face if you know your American history, or you know your history of the Union Army, the Grand Army of the Republic. You know, Lucas really slaps you around with that term and wakes you up and tells you that this has historical connections here. And, boy, that sent shivers through me when I heard that in the theater for the first time.
All right. Hang tight right there, Mark. I want to play this soundbite again real quick. Everybody listen up to this. This is George Lucas, the guy who created all this mess.
This idea of a democracy being given up, and in many cases being given up in a time of crisis, you see it throughout history, whether it's Julius Caesar or Napoleon or Adolf Hitler. You see these democracies under a lot of pressure, in a crisis situation, who end up giving up a lot of the freedoms they have and a lot of the checks and balances to somebody with a strong authority to help get them through the crisis. You know, it's not the first time a politician has created a war to try to stay in office.
To counter the increasing threats of the separatists.
It is done, then.
So, that's how the Galactic Civil War comes into being, is, in this case, Abraham Lincoln secretly controls Jefferson Davis all along. The whole Civil War is just a scam.
Well, it's been described many, many different ways. Lucas's point about starting a war, I think that that's one thing that Americans have the most difficult time with, that their politicians would start a war or egg somebody on or instigate or conflict with other nations. And it basically represents a simple lack of historical understanding, because this happens all the time, where leaders will go out and create circumstances, create emergencies, real or imagined, in order to grab power, grab authority, with the idea that they will fix things and then will return back to normal. And, of course, as history shows, in the case of Caesar and Napoleon, Hitler, the leader doesn't fix anything. The leader just simply continues to grab more and more power, and more and more war, and more death and killing, until eventually the whole thing crashes in ashes, with, you know, your average citizen completely either killed or destroyed, or completely upended, in the case of the Roman Empire, in the case of Napoleon's French Republic, and, of course, in Hitler's Germany. Look at all the death and destruction. And so Americans have got to open up their eyes to our own history and our own wars, and simply, look at the truth of the matter, and don't give up your liberties. Don't give up your freedoms. Don't give up the checks and balances. Don't change the Constitution or the legal system just for a matter of convenience, just in order to get things done. You know, every time they Congress gives the president the authority to negotiate a peace treaty or negotiate a free trade agreement, and they give up their own role and their own power in it, you know, that's an example of this whole process that Lucas is describing here, and it's something that Americans have got to wake up to.
Something that happens in Episode 3 is that the Emperor basically, in revealing himself as the bad guy, forces the hand of the Jedi to come and kill him. And then, of course, without giving too much away, they all die. Everybody knows they all die, except Yoda and Obi-Wan at the end, anyway, and the Emperor lives. So after the Emperor kills all the Jedi, then he goes out in front of the Senate and says, hey, these Jedi just tried to coup d'etat me. Can you believe that? Why, they're traitors to the Republic. They just tried to take over. He announces the Night of the Long Knives and issues Execute Order 66 to the clone army across the galaxy to kill all the Jedi Knights.
The time has come. Execute Order 66.
So I wonder, what are historical analogies there that you can come up with maybe to reflect that final betrayal as the power is ultimately consolidated?
Well, you know, we don't know what's the whole picture of this movie, but we do know a great deal of it because it has to mold from 3 to 4. You know, I'm kind of drawing a blank here as with respect to what is.
Well, I got two. I got the Night of the Long Knives, which it's hard to basically, you know, have the SA stand for the Jedi, but it is, you know, definitely when Hitler was finally consolidating all his power and striking deals with the German military. That he would only use them, that basically they had the Night of the Long Knives and stabbed all the SA in the back. Killed
them
all.
What I was trying to come up with was something that where you would sort of trick the Jedi into the position that they found themselves in, where they realized that the Emperor was the problem.
Oh, the coup part, yeah.
Yeah, the coup part is a way of instigating a war and then claiming, you know, we've got to stop this. And, you know, you might think in terms, a lot of people have suggested that Franklin Delano Roosevelt really instigated the Japanese into attacking the U.S. by a lot of his policies in the Far East, a lot of the things that he did, which were insults to the Japanese and the emperor, and that he was sort of egging them on. And then when the Japanese did attack, of course, he uses that as a way to get the U.S. into the war, something he said he'd never do, something that the American people were 90% against being involved in that war.
Right.
And so, you know, the instigation type thing is very prominent in historical analysis. And, you know, people think that if Roosevelt had handled the Japanese differently, that they would have attacked us.
No, well, they knew better. They're a tiny little island. They know they can't win against us. And yeah, you're right. I mean, well, that's going more back into Episode 2 and instigating the war. With the coup, the only one I can think of with the coup is like Huey Long one time faked an assassination attempt, or at least claimed that someone had tried to assassinate him to consolidate power in Louisiana, which isn't too much. But on the giant stab in the back, what the execution of the Jedi Knights reminds me of the most is the, and I'm not really certain how apt this analogy is, but the Knights Templar in 1307, they had been the guardians of Christendom during the Crusades and invading Arab lands, and they got too powerful, apparently, for the Pope, and so having them spread all across Europe, he sent out secret orders that on Friday the 13th, I think it was October the 13th, 1307, that right at midnight, all the different Templars were supposed to be arrested, prosecuted, and burned at the stake, etc. And it was all supposed to happen at once so that none of them could warn each other and that kind of thing. And I don't know if Lucas is really playing off that or not. I wouldn't necessarily characterize the Templars as Jedi Knights, but... I don't know. I'm stretching maybe, but it seems like possibly somewhere.
It sounds plausible. I hadn't thought about that at all, actually, but it sounds plausible. We'll have to work on that one, I guess, and see. I guess what I'd like to do is see that whole thing in context in the movie, and I think something might
right.
something might come out of it at that point.
Okay, now in the later episodes, wow, we're almost out of time, too. In the later episodes, we get much more into the American Revolution. And I don't know if episode 4 really has that many historical analogies. There may be some that I'm really overlooking, but I'm thinking of episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back, where they're on the ice planet Hoth, I think is a pretty good analogy to Valley Forge, right? All the Imperial officers are British, all the American, all the rebels are Americans, right?
That's right. Yeah, and the whole battle, you know, 4, 5, and 6 are, you know, the Star Wars battling scenes that made the series so popular and so famous, and you basically got, you know, the underdogs versus the big guys, and I think that's what it is the big guys are coming in and the underdogs beat them in some cases.
Absolutely, just like the American Revolution. All right, guys, we'll be back right after these commercials to wrap up with Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Talking Star Wars, you better hurry up and get your tickets before it's too late.
To do. It's not that I like the Empire. I hate it, but there's nothing I can do about it right now.
All right, my friends, welcome back. We're wrapping up the weekend interview show. And before I forget, I have to mention, I almost forgot, Viktor Yushchenko, the guy who is now the president of Ukraine. There's a great Star Wars analogy to him where he faked his own poisoning. Well, it actually was poison. I don't know who poisoned him, but it wasn't the KGB, because surely they would have used something that would kill him if it was the KGB trying to do it. But anyway, so I guess he got his doctor friend to poison him so that he could pretend to be a victim. And he played just like Palpatine does in episode 3. Oh, look at my face. Look what those evil people tried to do to me. Help consolidate a little bit further. So there was my Yushchenko reference in Star Wars. I love that. As soon as I saw, well, enough about the upcoming episode 3, and I immediately thought of Yushchenko.
That's not bad, Scott.
Palpatine-looking face of his. And I also should say, Mark, that, you know, a big part of this story that, you know, maybe we sort of skipped over in looking at more of the big picture kind of historical analogies and that kind of thing, is that the story is about free will. The story is about you have the choice. Now, when Obi-Wan asks Luke, hey, I need you to learn the ways of the Force and come with me to Alderaan, Luke says, I can't. I got obligations to my uncle. Sorry. And then, of course, when his uncle and aunt are killed, then he goes off because he's really got nothing to stay for anyway. But when his father's offered the chance, come on, we're the Jedi, we're coming off to take you to learn the ways of the Force, he says, all right, let's do it. Luke's reluctant. His father goes for it.
Yeah, you know, no matter how powerful, no matter how devious, no matter how, you know, monstrous an empire can become or a government can get, we always must remember that as individuals, we have that free will and we have the power to overthrow those kind of empires, because empires, you know, they have power, they have weapons, but ultimately, if we stand up to them, they will crumble. It's just a matter of you having the will and the commitment to doing that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I think that's why as much flack and bad feeling as Luke has gotten with the Ewoks, because they're just too darn cute and cuddly, in Return of the Jedi, I think he was trying hard. In fact, he said specifically, the Ewoks are the Vietnamese. The Ewoks are non-technological, and yet they bring the empire to its knees. And just as the Vietnamese did to the United States, just as the Iraqi insurgents are doing to the United States right now. The giant technological empire is no match for true believers.
That's right. In all those battle scenes, you know, the underdog can win. You know, without the high technology, without the mighty, you know, mechanical, technologically advanced, sophisticated devices, you know, we can overcome, in other words, like the American revolutionaries did, like the Vietnamese did. All great empires are defeated by, you know, like Afghanistan. You know, tribal hunters take down and kick out the mighty Soviet Union. So it happens over and over again, and you can't give up. You can't think of these empires as being undefeatable. You can't fear them because their whole base is on the willingness of us to give in to their power. And that's their whole foundation.
Absolutely. And the fact of the matter is that tyranny just doesn't work, does it, Mark?
It doesn't work. And I want to invite all listeners to Mises.org to register their comments on our blog about Star Wars, Mises.org.
Absolutely. And everybody, just bookmark that site no matter what. That's the best. That's the center of libertarian thought on the web. Mises.org, also LouRockwell.com. Thanks again so much for coming back on the show, Mark. I sure appreciate you.
Great to be here, Scott.